Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 139 of the podcast, everybody, with me, Dan Prosser, and my co-host, Andrew Frankel. Now, this week we're talking about magazine long-term test cars. I hope that we can sort of explain to all of you why magazines run long-term test cars. Is it just a blag, or is there a good sort of rigorous purpose behind these cars? Me and Andrew, we talk about some of the cars that we've run before, the ones that we've loved, the ones that we've perhaps hated and been glad to see the back of. I think there are some good tales in there as well, so hopefully you'll enjoy this topic. I also, before we get into long-termers, I also just wanted to talk about the Lamborghini Huracan Storato, the sort of new off-road one that has been revealed in the last few days. We talk about the terrible promotional video that Lamborghini produced to launch that car. We also talk about an article that I've written recently for the Intercooler app and website about competing in grassroots motorsport. So we discuss those things, but we get stuck into long-term test cars after a few minutes. Thanks for listening. Plunging new depths of self-indulgence this week, potentially, Andrew, because we're talking about the magazine long-term test cars we've loved and maybe the ones we've hated as well. I mean, that is an indulgent topic, but I don't know. We have license to do that from time to time, I think.
And because we're journalists and we are people who are notoriously averse to putting our hands in our own pockets and actually buying cars ourselves, these are sort of, okay, they are our long-termers, but in anybody else's world, these would be the cars that, these would be our daily drivers, wouldn't they? So what we're actually doing is talking about the cars we've been knocking about in over the years,
yeah,
which just happened to have been, you know, not owned by us.
And hopefully we'll demonstrate that just because they are essentially a free car, we haven't necessarily softened our view towards them or given them an easy ride. But we'll come to this in a moment. There are a couple other things I want to talk about first. I just want to give a story that I published this week on the Intercooler app and website a bit of a push, because I went and competed in an auto solo event, which is a proper back to basics, grassroots form of motorsport. And we have a partnership with Motorsport UK, the governing body for motorsport in this country. And they have a new initiative called Streetcar, and it's all about encouraging people to participate in motorsport in their everyday road cars, which is, you know, I think possibly until you hear that it's even possible, it might not occur to you that you might be able to do such a thing. But whatever road car you've got, you know, it might even just be a little city car or something, you could go and compete in a very cheap, very affordable form of motorsport if you wanted to. I did this auto solo at Donington Park on a big tarmac apron they've got there. And it, I had to join the Loughborough Motor Club, which cost £20. I had to pay a £51 entry fee. But apart from that, that was it. You don't need, well, you do need a Motorsport UK license, but it's free to get. It's called RS Clubman. It's free to get and it takes minutes to apply for. And with minimal effort, almost no hassle whatsoever, I found myself competing in motorsport. And it's properly licensed, properly regulated, timed motorsport. And I just think it's fantastic that there's this new initiative out there and it takes so little money, so little effort, and anyone can go and do it.
So let's just say, I don't know, wherever you're doing this is, I don't know, 100 miles, you know, say an hour and a half from where you live. What, everything, including your fuel for getting there, I don't know, sandwich when you get there, the entry fees, everything else. What would the whole cost of doing that event be to a punter who goes there in their, you know, their Series 1 MX-5 or something like that?
I reckon...
Presumably you're not going to get through any consumables, really, are
no,
you?
No. No, particularly it was wet the day that I did it, which just helps the tyres, helps the brakes. But, you know, it's probably £100. If you haven't yet joined the member, the motor club, it's maybe £120, £130. But, you know, as
a... You have to do that once, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. But as a... That's a day out, maybe with some mates, competing in motorsport. And it costs...
If you think about just how easy it is to spend £100 on a ticket to almost anything, or yeah. You know, if there are more than one of you going, or you know, a meal out with the family or anything, £100 just disappears these days, doesn't it?
It does.
Touch the sides.
And I think I probably was myself, but it's easy to be sniffy about driving around if you're in a manual car, probably mostly in first gear around some cones, because it's not circuit racing, is it? It's not 100 miles an hour through Cranor curves. But just think about the cost, the effort, the time commitment that goes into competing in circuit racing, you know, as well as anybody.
We call it rushing to wait and waiting to rush. You spend huge amounts of time doing nothing. That's basically what motor racing is, punctuated by very, very brief periods of frantic activity, which cost you. I mean, I can remember when I first started racing, back in the early 1990s, I guess. And I had this big Chevy Camaro because it was cheap and I didn't think I'd get hurt if I crashed it. The unit cost was over £100 a lap of the Indy circuit at Brands, which took a lot less than a minute to get around. So I was spending over £100, you know, and this was 30 years ago. I was spending £100 a minute racing that. If I didn't crash it, if I didn't blow it up, if everything went absolutely according to plan, it was £100 a minute 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And you're talking about £100 today for an entire event.
Yeah, and I'm sure, I know for a fact that circuit racing is ultimately a much more thrilling form of motorsport. But you just have to remember that Auto Solo is £100 and it takes almost no effort to get on the start line.
Well, I haven't done it, but I know, I mean, I've skidded around codes before and it's fun.
It's so fun.
And it's competitive. You are being timed against other people. So you do get to benchmark yourself. So, you know, your competitive juices start flowing. And, yeah, it's not circuit racing, but, you know, it's not the cost of circuit racing, is it? Well, I'm glad you did it. I want to have a go now.
Yeah, it's good fun. So Motorsport UK are really pushing this. So if you want to know more, just Google Motorsport UK street car and you'll find the website. All the information's there. It's very easy. I took part in... I wanted to... make a story of it. So I took part in what I thought was one of the least appropriate cars I could imagine, which was a big, heavy, extremely powerful electric car. You know, I was just curious to see what would happen. It was a Kia EV6 GT. Auto Solo, you need a little light, lithe, nimble car for darting around all these cones. What you don't necessarily need is a tall 2.2-ton thing with almost 600 horsepower.
What would be the perfect, an Atom?
Caterham. Caterhams are quick, very quick. Your car would be good. But an MX-5, a Mark 1 MX-5, or any MX-5, frankly, they're really quick. But they're brilliant fun as well. Front engine, rear drive, so you're skidding them around. Manual box, buzzy little engine, cheap. They're absolutely ideal for it. But when you go there and you see people using K11 Micras, old Novas, Corsas, someone turned up in a diesel 308. You know, it's fantastic.
Also, if you've never done any form of motorsport before, and you're just And you don't want to just go and buy a race car or buy a drive and something scary. You know? You just want to stick, you know, the tip of one toe in the water and just see what it's like to be in a competitive situation while driving a car. It's just perfect, isn't it? And then if you know, there'll be some people who go there and think, well, that was fine, but, you know, I feel I've ticked that box and don't want to do it again. Yeah. And other people will go, ooh, hang on. I might want to do a bit more of this. And then you're off.
Yeah, away you go. And I promise you, if it's the first form of motorsport you've ever participated in, you will experience those same nerves that you do before your first circuit race. You've written about it. It's a curious thing, isn't it? But there comes a moment where you just think, actually, I'd rather be anywhere but here.
I was talking to, as you do, for something which we're going to be doing a bit later on. I was talking to Gordon Murray day before yesterday. And we were talking about his first ever race. And this is Gordon Murray, okay? This is the man who's designed championship winning Formula One cars. And he's talking about me sitting in the grid in his home-built car in 1967 or 68 and some track in South Africa, thinking exactly the same thing. That everybody thinks the first time they do any form, basically thinking there's nowhere in the world I wouldn't rather be than here right now. And then suddenly the flag drops and it all just disappears.
Or you leave it behind on the start line.
It's absolutely remarkable. If you've not had that feeling, however terrible it is while you're having it, the moment it goes is a moment of utter revelation, isn't it?
Yeah, it is amazing. It really is amazing. Okay, well, if you want to find out how I got on in that Kia, just go and check out the story on the Intercooler app and the-intercooler.com. It's there waiting for you. Briefly, let's just mention the Lamborghini Huracan Storato, which is another one of
these. Can we talk about the video?
We do actually have to talk about the video, don't we?
Oh, okay, there's a theory. Well, can we talk about Keane Harpist as well?
Yes, we can. There's a theory, though, that this video was intentionally terrible, but I don't buy it.
I don't believe it. I don't buy it.
There's a creative agency somewhere that's hoodwinked. Actually, they don't even think they've hoodwinked Lamborghini. They probably think they've done a wonderful job, but it's just dreadful, isn't it?
Go and watch. Yeah, I mean, how would they find it? It's on Twitter. It's all over Twitter. Richard Porter's done a fantastic spoof of it. It's basically the promo video for the Lamborghini Storato. If you find someone saying in the opening few seconds of it, concrete yearners, you'll know you've got the right video. So about, 10 years ago, I would think, Aston Martin, for the Rapide, I think, produced the world's worst promotional video. Which was basically this appalling Bond ripoff, in which people have to say what they do for a living. One of them announces that he's a keen harpist, and this kind of achieved legendary status within the industry. The moment it went, I think they pulled it almost immediately after because it had such a the effect was so much the opposite of what they intended it to be. I never thought that anyone would ever do anything that bad again. But Lamborghini have managed it.
it compares.
If it's a spoof, what I want to see is the blooper reel. Okay, I want to see all the
laughing
where all these people are just wetting themselves. At this ridiculous thing. And I bet it doesn't exist because I bet it's serious.
Yeah, it's sort of perfume ad levels of nonsense, isn't it? It is extraordinary. The thing about this ad in particular is that the car is really exciting and you could make a fantastically evocative, engaging video, promotional video of just the car itself. I think Porsche basically did with the 911 Dakar.
Well, the Dakar, which is you know, a similar sort of thing, isn't it?
Very similar sort of car.
And they went and they just did a proper professional, exciting promotional video.
Mm. Showing the car off at its best. And this is just not that. Go and watch it. It's very funny. It'll brighten up your day. But the car itself, we've compared it already to the 911 Dakar, and it's another one of those off-road supercars, which is this new genre, isn't it? This new category of car that seems really quite exciting. We just need to have a go in one of them. So it's got the V10, of course. It's the Huracan. Still four-wheel drive. It's got wider tracks. It's got knobbly tyres, a bit like the 911 Dakar. It's lifted by 44 millimetres, which is... So the 911 Dakar is lifted by 50, and then it's got another 30, hasn't it, on a lift. The Lamborghini's got half the extra ride height, and presumably it is a lower car already than the 911 GTS, which is what the Dakar's based on. So probably the 911 Dakar's got a good deal more ground clearance. Someone's going to get them both together. We need to try and make sure it's us. That's going to be a hell of a twin test, isn't it?
Yes, I fear after the relentless mocking of their video that we may not be that high up the queue. But yes, it's all done in jest, Lamborghini. Please let us drive your car.
Well, this is it. But it is done in jest. And because the car, I love the idea of the car and I'm desperate to have a go. But the video is just laughable.
You know, you have to be able to put your hand up and go, okay, yeah, we perhaps slightly over-egged that one.
What's the line? Dust is gold.
I was laughing too much.
Okay. Let's leave that behind. All right, so we're talking about long-termers. They're the greatest blag ever, no? Isn't that it? Isn't it just car journalists on the blag?
Yeah, it is. Yes, absolutely. And insofar as that they are free cars, which get supplied to us by car manufacturers. But they are, okay, how do you defend them? You defend them because people who read about them find them really interesting.
Correct.
Do any research into these things as to what articles and what publications are the ones that are seen them, people turn to the most quickly and then spend the most time reading. It's always the long-termers. And I think it's because it's kind of the real world bit. Yeah. It's not just, you know, road testers up mountain passes going sideways in Lamborghinis or whatever. It's kind of the one moment where, we are sort of reminded of, the real world in which everybody lives. And it's, and it's useful for us to, you know, to live with a car, because there is absolutely an enormous difference between just driving a car for a day, which is what you tend to do on a launch, and living with a car for a number of months. And you find out all sorts of things. Mm. And certainly when I write long-term reports, I tend not to write about, you know, what the car is best known for. I don't know if it's a high-performance car, you know, writing about how fast it is. People kind of already know that, and they've got that from all the road tests they would have read. And it is a good opportunity to just live with the car and find out all those little things about it that annoy you, or all the, maybe all those little thoughtful touches which you wouldn't have been aware of, you know, in those few hours, you know, you spent behind the wheel when you first drove it. So, you know, so they are useful. And yeah, of course, they get us about.
They are useful. Okay, before we go any further, my only grievance with long-termers is when a magazine or a website, whatever, will take anything that's offered to them because the photographer needs a pool car. That almost feels like abuse of the whole point of a long-term. It should be something that's interesting to the reader, something that will reveal more about itself over time. And then long-termers are fantastic. This was going to be a listener question. So a shout out to Graham King for sending this question in. I was just going to do 5 minutes at the end of an episode, but I thought, actually, let's spin this out into a full episode. So Graham, thank you. And he specifically asks, have we ever come close to buying a long-termer that we've run? I think he's specifically asking about the exact car that we've run, but we can also talk about, you know, buying a similar car or the same car later on in life. So have you, I mean, you must have run a few cars. Have you ever run the numbers on one?
Yeah. There was a 335D touring BMW. You remember that car? 286 horsepower, 3 litre diesel, 3 series touring. And I did try and buy it because I got on with it so well. And it just fitted my life. And we had a young family at the time, and it just would have worked. I loved the fact that it was, I can remember having a sort of an impromptu, you know, run up the road with somebody in an RS4 Audi, and it didn't get away. And it was so fast, and I just loved it. I just really, really enjoyed it, but I just couldn't afford it. It was just, you know, I guess I was kind of hoping that they'd say, oh, we'll, you know, the BMW would say, we'll sell it to you for the price that we'd sell it to our dealer for, i.e. a trade price. Not a bit of it. They were actually very proper and correct about it. They said, well, it'll go to a dealer. We'll let them know that you're interested. And then you can have a conversation with them. And the dealer wanted to charge me full retail, which is absolutely fair enough, and I couldn't afford it. So that was the end of that. Okay. How about you?
Not quite, but I did run a Mark 7 VW Golf R pre-facelift for a year, and now I've got a Mark 7.5 GTI. So, you know, it might well be that having lived with that Golf R for a while, realizing how effortlessly they slot into your lives, I thought that's the car for me next time, albeit with two fewer drive shafts and a bit less power. So possibly, but what I remember really fondly is my first job in this line of work. 21 years old, moved to Kent. My granddad, bless him, had very, very generously given me a car. He'd bought a new car, so he gave me his old car. And for a few months, this was my car. This is how I got around, which is great, except it was an automatic Vauxhall Vectra 1.6.
Ooh.
And it was absolutely lamentable. I remember collecting it from him, and he was talking me through the controls. Thoughtful. And on the automatic gear selector, there was a button marked S, and he said, S, that's for a speedy getaway. fantastic. But, you know, it was a free car, and it got me around. And later on, I sold it, so thank you, Grandad. But I sold it because I got my first long-termer. and I was a kid at Christmas when this thing turned up. It was a black, brand new Suzuki Swift Sport, the first generation one. And what I distinctly remember is in the weeks before its arrival, just doing endless laps on Gran Turismo in a Suzuki Swift Sport. Just, I don't know what I was doing. Just preparing myself for this car, learning how, I don't know. But it just shows the level of excitement. And it was fantastic. And I think I had it for a year. Super fun thing to drive, particularly when you're 21 and not very thoughtful. And I took it to Brunters and it would slide about really beautifully when you lifted off the throttle. Buzzy little engine, just mega.
Can I talk about my first long-termer?
You can.
I'd been on autocar for a while. And back then, if you're a road tester, you didn't get a long-termer because you didn't need one because you were testing anything. And then I think they just got sick of me and they thought I needed to bring it back down to size. So they decided they're going to stick me on the news desk. and my job was to produce this thing called Database, which was a spread at the back of the magazine every week, detailing thrilling things like where the latest roadworks were on the M1.
Oh, God.
Top 10 best-selling cars in Britain. All this sort of... And that was my life. So I went from testing 911s to basically being the traffic news. And the wonderful cars I was road testing on a daily basis got replaced by a long-termer, which was, you won't even remember what this is, a Proton 1.5 GLS.
Wow.
It was the first Proton into the country. And it was, I'll tell you what was most annoying about it, which was that it wasn't so unfit for purpose, I could just chuck it back. It actually worked in a perfectly adequate way. It was horrible. It had no charm of any description at all. It was a car almost entirely devoid of any form of merit, but it didn't break down. It had some room in it, and it got me about, but I was just miserable. And I can remember sitting, the office used to be in Teddington, and I had about a sort of like a 10-mile commute. And I can remember sitting in very heavy traffic on the A316, miserable in this thing. And there was a big pale gray plastic shroud around the sunroof. It had a sunroof, which fell off and landed on my head. So I ended up sort of wearing this thing as a necklace. And it was this slimy gray. And I can just sit here thinking, there has to be more to life than this. and The only thing that saved me was, however bad a road tester I was at the time, I was an even worse news hound. And so they chucked me off the news desk. Nobody else wanted me. They couldn't quite find sufficient grounds to fire me, so they put me back on the road test desk. And I was happy again after that.
And so began a glittering career. So what were Proton hoping to achieve by sending you that car for a while?
Exposure. You know, they were just hoping, you know, they were new into the country.
Get it in the magazine, yeah.
Get it in the magazine and, you know, and take the hit, you know. All publicity is publicity. And also, you know, the car wasn't, you know, there were lots of really, really awful cars. I mean, we forget that these days because, you know, there's that old hoary adage about there's no such thing about a car anymore. Well, to an extent, it's true. Although, and this is another conversation, I think we may be getting back into an era with electric cars where such things as truly bad cars, particularly for the price, come back. But back then, there were some really, really terrible cars. I mean, yeah, back then I drove things like FSOs and Zastavas and Yugos and, you know, Skodas before Skoda were bought by Volkswagen. And, you know, there were some true, I remember a thing called a Mahindra Indian Chief, which was Mahindra's attempt to do a sort of a Jeep. And I can remember getting in the car, discovering it had no fuel in it, driving it to the fuel station, filling it up, and instead of going home, driving it back to the office and parking it because it was so unbelievably awful. I'd rather take public transport. So yeah, that's the only car basically I've refused to drive because it was, I didn't think it was safe. And it was, the ride was so abominably awful that even in Teddington, it was just, you know, it was doing my back in and, you know, and so on and so forth. So, So, I mean, back then, cars were awful, but the Proton wasn't. The Proton was just mediocre. It was staggeringly, stultifyingly, gravity-defyingly mediocre. And, yeah.
So what long-termer have you enjoyed having more than any other? What's the highlight? You've run some cool stuff, even recently.
Yeah, well, I could tell you there is one which absolutely stands out, but I thought I might sort of keep it for the end a little bit. Well, okay. So, well, what I can say is that of all, if I could have one long-termer again, actually, it's another BMW. I had an i8 for a year. Goodness me, I love that. I hated the attention it got, but I think that that is one of those cars that people will look back on and think, did they really do that then? Did they really, you know, back then in 20, whatever it was, I think it came out in 2014, or maybe even earlier, did they have a car with, you know, carbon fiber construction, with a three-cylinder mini engine in it, which you could plug in, had a decent all-electric range, which looked that good, which worked so well. I mean, to me, it was a postmodern 911. It was just a car that you were just so happy just to see it parked outside your house. And, you know, I think that in the press, I mean, I loved driving it. I thought it sounded good. People said, oh, you know, the noise is all synthesized, but all noises cars make these days, one extent or another, are synthesized. There was nothing about that car I didn't like, apart from it had quite a small boot, and if you parked it next to somebody, you couldn't park it next to anything in any car park because those gullwing doors meant you couldn't get out of the car. But other than that, that's the car. I often think to myself, you know, when this business has had enough of me, what would I go and get? I think I'd probably go and get an i8.
Interesting, very interesting. Do you remember when you first tested an i8 bit on the launch or when you had one for a week in the UK, also, and did your impressions of the car change having run one?
Oh, completely. And this is exactly the point of the long-term test. Yeah. You know, the i8 is almost the definitive example of a car that is better to live with than it is to drive. I can remember driving it. It was the launches up in Scotland, and BMW did it really well because they flew us up there in a private jet. And people, when they hear that, always think, oh, that's, you know, that's journalists being, you know, pampered. And to an extent it was, but actually the reason they do it is that if you're going to book 26 seats, it's often cheaper to do it that way. But anyway, so we flew up to Inverness, and I can remember We came down the steps of the aircraft and all the I-8s were there in a row. We literally just walked out of the aircraft and into an I-8 and set off over the Highlands. And I can remember thinking, this is a lovely car. And coming back and writing a positive report of it, but not really thinking that much more about it. But it kind of left enough for me to think, gosh, if ever the opportunity came up to run one as a long term, well, that'd be good. But to live with, it was so much better. It was just, you know, because then you could really appreciate, you know, the ride and the refinement. And I'm not really a huge person for the way a car looks. And I have no interest whatever in whatever it is people think their car says about them. But it was, to me, it's a stunning design. And it was just a nice thing to have parked outside your house. And all I can tell you is it made every journey an occasion. And there was never a time when I wasn't pleased to see it. And it's this thing, I've mentioned this about other cars. Well, you know, if you fly in from, you've been away for a while, you come back and it's Heathrow and it's dark and it's raining and you're tired and cheesed off. What is sitting there waiting for you becomes actually quite important. Because if it's something like an I-8, you're basically home 3 hours before you're home. Yeah. Whereas if it's something which is, you know, horrible or just, you know, bland or mediocre and it's just a tool for doing a job, then you don't get that. So those sorts of things, you know, when you do the sorts of mileages that we do and you're away as often and as much as we are, those sorts of things become really, really important. And yeah, loved it.
Yeah, I agree about the I-8, absolutely. Around the time that I-8 was new, actually, 2014 or something, I started at Evo as a road tester, and I was due a long-termer. And I thought, here we go, hit the big time. Where's my 911? Where's my BMW M car? Mercedes AMG, that'll do. And they chucked me a Vauxhall Corsa, albeit a VXR Club Sport. So, you know, a quick one. But
it wasn't terrible, actually. I remember that car.
Do you know what? I was disappointed when I heard that's what I was getting. And actually, it was a bit annoying to live with because it's a very bouncy car. Not harsh in terms of ride, but just always bouncy. And there's weird things about it, like the throttle mapping and the steering, that made it just a bit annoying. But when you had it on the right road or on a track, like a little handling track, or I did a hill climb in it, it was lightning up that hill climb. It was so good. It had this really tightly wound limited slip differential that just actually, more than any other diff that I've ever come across, it dominated the driving experience. It totally defined how you drove that car, because you would just launch it into a corner and the instant you could get on the gas, you would do so, and it would just drag you out of the bend. No matter how fast you went in, if you could just get on the power early, it would drag you out and sort you out. And I remember launching it up the hill at Gersten Down, which is a great hill climb course. And somehow, because the car was so grippy and quick and it had that diff, monstering everything else, it was brilliant fun. And we did at Evo, we did a long-termers away day. We went to Blyton Park and we all set a time in this car around a little handling course. And it was just fantastic. You could, honestly, around a tight little second, maybe third gear handling course, this car was quicker than all sorts.
Did it beat any of the big stuff?
Well, we didn't actually time it against the big stuff. What we did was everyone set a time in the Corsa. But I know, having driven everything else that day, I know the Corsa would have been quicker than all sorts of other powerful rear drive cars. But it was just fantastic. And then, of course, on the drive home, it was really annoying again. So I was, after 6 months or whatever, I was quite pleased to see it go. But that was an interesting, again, I suppose that's revealing about why having a long term is a useful exercise. Because if you just drove one on the launch event and they chose the roads well, perhaps had you on a handling track at some point, you'd think it was fantastic. But the rest of the time, it's just profoundly annoying to live with. And then I remember the one I had after that was a BMW M4. And so there you go. That was me arriving. That was me thinking, here I am at Evo, made it. And of course, it wasn't quite the car we all hoped it would be.
No, no. I'm just thinking of things. Again, talking about cars which were just unexpectedly great to live with. And I had a Focus ST only about a year ago, maybe a bit more, 18 months ago, I can't remember. And I had that for a year. And I genuinely thought when it turned out, I thought this is going to be a bit of fun. But I'll have a year of it. And I'll probably be quite pleased to get out of it and into something else at the end of that year. And I wasn't. I didn't want to give it back. It was... That car handled so well, just such a, and now that Ford are killing all these cars and, you know, all those, you know, Fiestas and Focuses and everything else, it just makes you realize, you know, it made me think hard about just how good those cars were. And I put it up against all sorts of things. I put it up against a Series 8 Golf GTI. I put it up against a Mustang, 5-liter Mustang, because, you know, they was like the sort of the yin and the yang. Or Ford performance cars, you know, one, you know, with a, you know, front wheel drive with a turbocharged four cylinder engine and the other rear drive with a naturally aspirated V8. And the Focus just blitzed both of them. Hmm. It was just, you know, you think, yeah, Ford Focus, you know, this isn't, you know, an RS, this is an ST, anything against a 5-liter V8 manual Mustang. You think, well, I mean, come on. Absolutely not. It wasn't just quicker point to point. It was more fun to drive. It came on those brilliant Michelin Pilot 4S tires. And, you know, I got to a point with it where, apart from the slightly shabby interior, there was nothing about that car that I wouldn't have been happy to go on living with for a very, very long time after that. It's the most disappointing long term you've ever had.
I'm glad you asked that, Andrew, because this is where expectation and reality proved to be two quite
different. Was it the M4?
It wasn't the M4, actually. No, I quite liked having the M4. You know, I was well aware of its limitations, and it frightened me a few times. Particularly, you know, in the wet and when it's cold and when its super sport tyres haven't come up to temperature, and even just on an upshift, and the thing gives you a big spike of oversteer. Oh, it's... really disconcerting. But actually, I liked having it the rest of the time. I thought it was pretty good to live with. But the one that I thought was going to be fantastic and actually was a bit disappointing was, and you'll understand this the moment I say it, Audi R8 Spider.
Yes, thereby hangs a tail.
So...
could you get comfortable in it?
No.
No.
No, not quite. Not quite. And so this one had the fixed back seats that were, well, actually, so they were very upright and they had a very thin back, which does mean they went back further than the standard seat. So you could have more legroom. You could create more legroom for yourself, which was helpful because in that car, and it's the same with the Lamborghini Huracan, the drop top one, you lose a big chunk of the cabin because of the roof mechanism or something.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. And so if you're tall, you just won't get comfortable.
I'm 6'3". I can remember I had it and I took it to Bath, which is only about, 30 miles away from me. And really having to steel myself for the journey back because I was in so much pain on the way there. It's just ridiculous. But they basically just thought, well, if you're over 6 foot, tough, you don't matter. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, I've never found them comfortable, always just in a slightly awkward position. So this red one that I had, it did have the seats that meant you could go back further. So my legs were sort of stretched out as they wanted to be at least, but they were bolt upright and just not comfortable to sit in, which was part of the problem. But also, you know, it was heavier, much heavier than the coupe, and you felt it. It just wasn't as fast as you thought it should be. And it meant that the engine felt a little bit strangled. You know, it wasn't a particularly engaging drive. Certainly not as good as the coupe. And so I found myself in this car that I found uncomfortable just to sit in. I found it not as exciting to drive as it should be. It didn't feel as fast as it should do. And so I'm just thinking, what am I getting out of this thing? And if I'd spent, 150 odd probably, at a guess, maybe a bit more, I don't know. But if I'd saved up a deposit and really stretched to afford the 1,500 quid, £2,000 a month payments, and I was committed to it for 3 years, for instance, I'd have been gutted. Because I actually didn't enjoy having it or driving it every day. The other thing about it was, it's so obnoxiously loud when you start it early, when you start it up from cold. And this was a time when I was living in Bristol, but working at Evo in Northamptonshire, and commuting, you know, clearly not doing it every day, but maybe two or three times a week. And so I'd be setting off early. And I remember staying at my my partner's house then, where we before we moved in together, staying in her flat a couple of times. And the car was parked on the road outside. And at 6 in the morning, I'd have to fire it up. And you get this. And for the first 20 seconds, it sits there going. It's trying to warm the cats up, isn't it, for the emissions. And it's sitting there going. And there's nothing you can do. And you're shuffling out of the tight parking space as quickly as you can, just desperate to get off down the road. And Imogen's flatmate thought I was doing it intentionally.
Of course, everybody will. Everybody will think you're just being a dick.
Yeah.
And, inconsiderate dick, waking everybody up in the street at 5 o'clock in the morning.
And you would assume that. You would assume that.
Well, you wouldn't sit there thinking, oh, yes, he's just warming his cats.
No.
They just think.
Knob.
He's big. Yeah, absolutely.
And I came down one morning. And someone had put a brick through the driver's side window.
Ooh.
Not nicked anything. They hadn't even reached inside. And I don't know if it was just a random... Well, it's not a random attack because it was a bright red Audi R8 and no other car had been attacked like that. But was it because of the noise it made? Or was it just because it's an ostentatious looking car and someone took an exception to it? Yeah, I mean, that, if anything, is going to take the shine off an ownership experience, in inverted commas. It's an attack like that, isn't it? And so in the end, quite pleased to see that one go.
Okay, so my most disappointing one was another example of cars which are different when you live with them to when you drive them. But this was the other way around. Was an Alfa Giulietta. There's a bit of me that will always, forever be Alfa Romeo, because I've been very lucky to spend quite a lot of time mucking about in old Alfas. I mean, not sort of, you know, massively valuable pre-war Alfas, but, you know, 1960s and 50s Alfas and that sort of thing. And I understand a bit about how the quality of the engineering that went into those cars, how hard they thought about what really mattered to the driver, and how they created this endless series of wonderful driving cars. And I, you know, ever since I became a motoring journalist and Alfa were just making dud after dud after dud, I'd be waiting for that moment when they just produced an affordable, compact, fun little car. And the Giulietta came along, and I think the launch was somewhere like Sardinia. And I don't know, it's just one of those occasions where, because you want it to be good, and because it was so much better than what Alfa Romeo had done in any recent past, you think, wow, it's here. They finally cracked it. They finally produced. But in fact, cold light of day back in the UK, when one turns up and you've got to live with it for a year, you just kind of realize that it wasn't a bad car. It was just disappointing. It just wasn't as good as, the Golfs and the other cars, which you might, normally buy instead of it. I quite like the look. And that 1.4-litre turbo engine was quite characterful, but the chassis just wasn't there. It just wasn't a properly indulgent, engaging hot hatch, which is all I wanted it to be. And every time I got into it, particularly, if you live where I do in the middle of nowhere, and you've got an early morning start, at least the first few miles are going to be a hoot because there's going to be nothing on the roads and you're going to be skidding around wonderful roads. And every time you get into it and you just think, well, it's not going to be a hoot because this car, it doesn't really turn in properly. It doesn't, react very much to throttle position. And it was just a bit turgid, a bit stodgy. It also had these weird pedals where the brake and the accelerator were at exactly the same level. Right. So You know, accelerators are always slightly below the brake. So you could just be, so even subliminally, your foot goes to that and you can feel the brake on that and you know you're on the right pedal. I lost count on the number of times I trod on both pedals by mistake. And I never got myself into a difficult situation. But it also made heel and toeing very, and it was just, I just remember being glad to give it back. And it was just, it was a nice car to drive, you know, on a decent day when you're not thinking too hard about, you know, but to actually live with it every single day, it just didn't do it. And I was really sad about that because I really thought that was going to mark a turning point for Alfa Romeo. As it is, we're still kind of waiting, aren't we?
So what did you, you've run some fairly tasty stuff as well. You've mentioned the R8, but I know you've had a McLaren, more than one. You had a 911 fairly recently.
Not that recently. It was a 991, so not that recently. But I mean, I wasn't really going to mention the 720S because it's so far beyond anything I'm ever likely to be able to have myself. But okay. So I had a 720S for 6 months, and it's one of the reasons. I mean, I absolutely adored that car. You know, if the i8 was the car that, you know, I might try and buy myself, and if the 335D was a car that I actually tried, I'd never try and buy a 720S because I could never afford it. And even if I could, I wouldn't know what to do with it. But the car I loved most, you know, unsurprisingly, because it was like $250,000 worth of car by the time it had a few bits on it, was that car. And in 6 months, and I thought I was going to make the most of this, and I absolutely mullered that car. It went around so many racetracks. It did so many. I drove it to Geneva one day, did the press day the next, and then drove it home again over the mountains, always, you know, taking the scenic route. Didn't spare it anything. And, you know, and McLaren has this reputation for having, you know, uneven reliability records, stuff going wrong with that car. All I can tell you is that in 6 months and whatever it was, 10,000 miles that I did in that car, the only thing that went wrong with it was there was once it flashed up a warning saying the headlights had lost their ability to look round corners. They didn't turn with the steering wheel anymore. And the next time I turned it back on again, the warning had cancelled itself and the car was fine. That was it. It was bomb-proof. I've had Mercedes and BMWs and Audis, which have been much less reliable than that McLaren was, and I also love that the way that I can remember on those Geneva trips where you are, you know, despite, you know, your best intentions, you do still have to spend a long time sitting on motorways and just sitting there in that goldfish bowl with that wonderful visibility all around you, in quiet and comfort because they are quiet and they are comfortable. And then suddenly turning off the motorway, it's Dijon, isn't it, if you're going to go over the Jura Mountains. And suddenly this entire other animal appearing, which is so phenomenally, preposterously, unfeasibly rapid that, we said it before, you couldn't imagine a circumstance where you ever want any more performance than that. You know, actually driving that car fast on those roads was always an exercise in restraint. You were always holding it back, always holding yourself back. I just adored that car. But actually, if it was my car, I'd be frightened of damaging it. I'd be frightened of the costs of running it. And I'd probably rarely ever use it. So yeah, I'm very lucky to be able to do that. Can I just, before we wrap this up, can I just talk about the long-termer that I remember most fondly, the long-termer, which is the only one that I kind of miss because I'm very good because you have to be in this job, but you know, you drive a car and you get out of it and you move on to the next one. You just have to. But actually I miss this car. And if I could ever find it, well, I probably wouldn't buy it, but anyway, so when we're in 1994, I was on Autocar, and we built a Caterham. We built a red top, a Caterham 7 HPC, as it was at the time. So this was a car with a 2-litre Vauxhall engine on it, on 45 Webers stuck out the side. And over the course of the weekend, a bunch of us, it was James May, there was me, and a few other people whose names probably won't be familiar to people on this podcast, the idea was that we would go into a shed at the back of the office on a Friday evening and drive a caterer with a bunch of cardboard boxes and drive a caterer out on the Monday morning. It didn't quite happen, A, because catering forgot to supply a load of bits, and B, because we were utterly useless at building the thing. So the thing went back to catering. Jez Coates, who was the engineering boss of catering at the time, was kind enough to ring me up and say it was the worst built catering he'd ever seen in his life. They finished it off, by which I suspect means they actually basically took it to bits and started again. And then that car came back and I ran it for 6 months of my long-termer. And because I'd had a hand in building it, I took my girlfriend on holiday to France in it for a fortnight.
Wow.
And it was because she put up with that that I thought, she's probably a good type. And if she'll put up with that, she'll probably put up with most stuff. Anyway, whatever it is, thick end of 30 years later, she's still my wife and the mother of my children. And I just have, it never went, oh, it did one clutch cable, but it did a ridiculous number because it, I mean, not only was I driving it all the time, but everybody else wanted it. So it did like 20,000 miles in 6 months. And I think it did one clutch cable and that was it. And it was so fast and it handled so well. And there was just this sort of pride that that I'd had a hand in building. And one day I've always, although I'm useless with spanners, I've got enough mates who are pretty good. And again, when I, you know, this business is done with me, I might just go and build the car because it that did provide a dimension of enjoyment, which I haven't had with anything else.
Yeah, well, it's a great example of a car being so much more than just a means of getting around. So, so much more. It was a lovely story. Okay, well, that whole episode was a listener question. So thanks again, Graham King. All I have to do now is remind you all that you can now give a subscription to the Intercooler as a gift. Just head to the-intercooler.com and you'll see all the different options there. Please also rate and review the podcast. That's really important. It helps us find new listeners. And it just means we can do more and more with the podcast. So thanks all for listening. We'll be back next week.
See ya.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.